that's haunting, isn't it? The theme music from Peter Weir's classic 1975 film Picnic at Hanging Rock. The film was based on Joan Lindsay's novel of the same name, which was published 50 years ago this year. And it tells the story of a group of well-to-do schoolgirls who disappear very mysteriously during a picnic in a very spooky and primal place in fertile country, 75 k's northwest of Melbourne, Hanging Rock. Now, a very handsome new book looks at Joan Lindsay's life and work. It's called Beyond the Rock, and it's by Janelle McCulloch, who joins us right now. Hi, Janelle.
Hello, Michael. Lovely to be here.
Welcome to the studio. Just remind us of the story that the novel tells, because there'll be people listening overseas who perhaps don't know this story.
Of course. It's a very simple story. It's about a group of schoolgirls from a prestigious ladies' college who go on a summer's picnic to Hanging Rock, which is a very haunting outcrop of rocks just north of Melbourne. They go with their French mistress and their mathematics mistress and a driver as escorts. Three of the girls go for a walk on the rock and they subsequently disappear, and so does the mathematics mistress. One of the girls is found, but the rest of the missing group are never found. Excuse me. And the mystery is never solved, which is why it has endured for 50 years.
And the luminous girl who's the sort of leader of this group is called?
Is called Miranda.
Miranda.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's talk about, before we talk about the truth or falsehood or the fantasy behind all of this, tell us about the woman who wrote this intriguing tale. Joan Lindsay, what was her childhood like?
Joan Lindsay grew up in quite a large mansion in St Kilda in Melbourne. They had about half a dozen staff. Her father was a lawyer and then became a High Court judge. So her grandfather had been Governor General of Tasmania, and they had come from a very affluent family in England.
So they're real colonial blue bloods.
Absolutely. And they had an enormous garden at this mansion in St Kilda. She always said she was very influenced by gardens and by landscape, and that comes through in this novel very strongly, because it really is a novel that is as much about landscape as it is about people.
Oh, it's entirely about landscape. Mm. I mean, it's about the rock and this force that seems to emanate from the rock. And you feel it when you go there, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's a spooky place to visit.
The Indigenous Australians believe it's quite a sacred place, much like Uluru is, which is rock. They regard it as a very special place, and a lot of things have happened there over the years, a lot of turbulent things. But when you go there, it does seem to have this atmosphere there, and it's very hard to ignore. And the rocks themselves do look like faces, look like these old Indigenous tribal men. And I think that whether that's accident or Mother Nature, I don't know, but it certainly has this wonderful atmosphere.
So when did she first go there? Joan Lindsay, I mean.
She first went there at the age of four in 1900, which is the year she also set the novel. She turned four at the end of 1900, and her family went up there for a picnic. They went there every summer. And she spoke her first words at Mount Macedon, which is just near Hanging Rock. And it had a profound influence on her, or that summer that she spent there. But she had a great memory. Many writers do. But she remembered that year for the rest of her life.
So these girls go to this posh school, and it's based on a real school, Clyde, which is actually the school that she then went to herself.
Yes, it's a little bit confusing, because Clyde started in Melbourne as a city school, and Joan Lindsay went to it when it was a city campus, and then the headmistress decided to move it out to the country because she wanted fresh air. She didn't want the girls to be influenced by these city, the city ways. So they moved to this beautiful old boarding house at Wood End. And then that was in 1919, and it became Clyde. They called it the Country Clyde, as opposed to this, and they closed the city campus down. So it is a little bit confusing, but Joan did base the book on Country Clyde. But she did refute it, and that was for very good reasons. It was perhaps for legal reasons, because, of course, the publishers didn't want to face litigation from Clyde, or indeed any of the families who had gone to Clyde, because at that time Clyde was perhaps the most prestigious school in Australia, and all of the very wealthy families of Australia sent their daughters there to get – it was a bit like a finishing school.
So when you said she refuted it, she said that
It was not based on Clyde.
Nevertheless, there it was a practice at Clyde for the girls to go on picnics to Hanging Rock.
Yes. The first, Clyde moved out to Woodend in 1919, and the first picnic that they went on was at the end of 1919, and there is a record of this picnic in the Clyde magazine, the school magazine, and it was a very eerie and a very strange picnic that is recorded in this magazine, and that's where I found that there was distinct parallels between the novel and this real picnic that happened in 1919.
Let's come to those parallels in a moment. Just stick with Joan's own life. So she finished school. She studied painting at the National Gallery of Victoria Art School, which was a very prestigious art school, which is where she met the artist Darryl Lindsay, and they got married. And one of the great strengths of your book, I reckon, is the way in which it takes us inside this very privileged world of Melbourne's social elite, which I don't know, I use the word blue bloods, you might call them the Melbourne ruling class. This class is usually invisible to most people. They're very visible to themselves because they have places they meet, schools they go to, places they holiday. You tell us that Joan herself could be a bit of a snob.
She was, because she had come from this very upper class family. They were very conscious of of being part of the establishment in Melbourne, and her father, of course, was part of the legal fraternity. So she was a snob. But then, as she aged, I think she started to she didn't like pretentious behaviour. So she actually became a bit of an anti-snob. She sort of changed tact a bit because then she met, of course, when she married Darryl Lindsay, he was more of a bohemian. So she was much more in tune, I think, with this bohemian life. She loved Charleston in England and the Bloomsbury set.
Sure. But they're very connected to the establishment too. I mean, the thing about these so-called bohemians, which were the writers and the artists, is they sat alongside the financial elite because they're the people who buy pictures.
Oh, of course. And they had these salons in England and France. And that's, I think, what she wanted to create here, mixing their politician friends and their artistic friends and their influential, wealthy friends. But she was a snob, yes, but that I do think she changed as she grew older, as we all do.
What, we become nicer as we grow older, you reckon? There's a theory. This is Books and Arts, and I'm talking to Janelle McCulloch, who has produced a very, very handsome book called Beyond the Rock, The Life of Joan Lindsay and the Mystery of Picnic at Hanging Rock, which is full of beautiful illustrations. Now, at the heart of this book, it seems to me, is this tantalising prospect or proposition that there's something true about the story. And you start by telling us that she wrote a preface to the book, only part of which was published. Mm. The last two sentences were struck out by the publisher. And in the sentence that was struck out, she said, this story is pretty much true.
She says, this story is entirely true. Oh, and she uses the word entirely.
Entirely true. Okay. Now, the publisher said, no, I don't think we should say that.
No.
So the whole premise of the book depends on why the publisher did that and what she meant by saying this is entirely true. Now, you say, or you quote friends of Joan Lindsay who reckon that she was a mystic. Mm. And I feel that you sense that this is key.
Well, it's very difficult because it's such an esoteric thing, isn't it? And not very few of us understand what a mystic is and how they work. But
I do. I think a mystic is a charlatan.
Well, a lot of people do.
Yeah,
a lot of people do.
Yeah.
So I just have to go on what her friends. I didn't know Joan, and I have to really quote. I was very careful not to put my opinion in. And I sit on the fence anyway, but her friends felt that she...
So sitting on the fence means you think there's something in it.
Well, no, sitting on the fence means that I've put on my journalist's hat and I'm a little bit sceptic and I'm a little bit open-minded. Because when you're writing a book like this, I'm really just the storyteller. So I really had to gather all the information, interview all her friends, put them in and let other people have their opinion.
All right. So she had an odd relationship with time, you say.
Yes. Well, she could read the landscape like the Indigenous Australians could. She had an affinity with the landscape, but she certainly seemed to be able to read things in the landscape in terms of, you know, what mystics can do. But she could also, even Peter Weir, he said he had his own experiences at Gallipoli. So they kind of shared this thing that they had. But I'm not sure. I think she tended to play down that, and I think she was nervous, as Peter Weir probably was, about what people thought.
Yeah, but you say she had actually had an experience of a kind of time slippage.
Well, Martin Sharp said that. Martin Sharp was a very famous artist, as I'm sure you know. He's a very famous Australian artist, and he grew to know Joan Lindsay quite well on the set of Picnic at Hanging Rock. And she told him that she had had a profound experience in 1900 at Hanging Rock. At the end of 1900, when she was four, she'd just turned four, and she'd just said her first words, and it may well have been like at the start of 1901, you know, because the summer obviously in Australia goes from 1900 to 1901. But she told Martin Sharp that she had had a profound experience at the Rock. She said it was when she was young and with her sisters, and there seems to be more to that conversation, but he would never really elaborate. He just said there was something that happened at the end of that year. And whether he wouldn't elaborate or she wouldn't elaborate.
This is when she's an adult, she has this experience.
Yeah, she was four. She was aged four.
Oh, you mean when she was four?
Yes.
She remembers having a kind of time slippage experience.
Well, she had a remarkable memory. Even when she was 70, she could remember things that had happened to her. Right. She was also a great writer. I mean, obviously she couldn't write when she was four, but she had this incredible memory, like some people do. Particularly writers, that's a sort of a skill. Some people learn it, some people are born with it, but journalists have it too. So she remembered things that had happened to her, but something quite profound must have happened to her for her to. I mean, I went around Australia when I was 3 and a half with my parents for 4 months, and I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember, you know, Darwin and all these sorts of things. So I do think you can remember snippets of your life from four. Because when you turn five, of course, you're almost, you know. This is what Martin Sharp said, that she had this profound experience at Hanging Rock at the age of four in 1900. I think that's why she set the novel during this pivotal year. But her parents had also, just as a little aside, her parents had gone back to England to live, leaving her and her sisters in the care of their staff at St Kilda. So she had had this great sense of loss of her family for most of 1900. So I think that might have also affected her.
Okay, now let's come to this key question. What did she mean when she said this story is entirely
true? That is the whole question that we all... Because when I found that foreword, that original foreword that she had written, and it's hers, it's typed up, and it was in her part of the archives that had come from her, I thought, oh my goodness, because when a book is a novel, you don't need to, you just write a very nice short forward saying this or that. Conversely, if a book's nonfiction, it says that on the back jacket.
So she played with the idea that it might be true by putting a newspaper story at the start of it, a newspaper story she had written.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. To create the illusion this was based on a real event.
Yeah.
So it seems to me you've got two choices if you say the story is true. Either you say it's based on a real crime, there were girls who disappeared and we can discover the circumstances of those if we do some research. To me that seems unlikely because Clyde was a famous school and I can't imagine girls just vanished and were never reported, especially so late in the 20th century. But perhaps that's what you're referring to. And you think that there is a true crime that is yet to be fully drawn out.
Well, the girls who disappeared weren't part of Clyde. They were in the 1800s.
Right.
So Clyde came along in 1919 and the girls went on a picnic. They didn't disappear on the picnic, but there seems to be some kind of very strange event that happened at that picnic. The girls were up there until...
So hang on. So there was an earlier disappearance.
Yes. Yes. And that's all in the biography.
Yes. So who are these people who disappeared?
Well, in the Victorian Police Gazette, which was an internal gazette distributed between police stations weekly between the 1850s and up until the early 1900s, there is evidence of two girls disappearing in the Clyde, Woodend, Mount Macedon area at a certain time that I was told to look, but there's not enough evidence for me to know to go further or to put it into the book.
Right. Okay, because this is the strangeness of the way
it's all very strange.
Well, it's a strange way you've written the book because you start by telling us that she said it's entirely true.
Yes.
And you return to that quotation twice in the course of the book. And then we get to the end and you say, actually, I know that it's entirely true, but I'm not going to tell you why it's entirely true. So I've just read this enormous book, but you get to the very end and say, maybe I'll tell you in another book.
I have to apologise because we had to make a I had, actually, much like the original novel, I had a few extra chapters.
But what is it that you know you're not saying in the book?
Well, the publishers and I made a decision that the book had to be first and foremost a biography, right? So it had to be a biography about Joan's life. We had to address Picnic at Hanging Rock because it was a work of Joan's, but we had to, it really was a biography. There's a whole other book about the girls that could be written, but it's a
separate
story.
Which would say what?
Well, we need to do a little bit more research, or someone else does, because perhaps it needs to go to.
But the reason look, you draw us in with this idea that this book is entirely true.
No, I've drawn you in with the idea that this book is a biography about Joan Lindsay's life.
Right at the start of the book, you've said, and Joan Lindsay said it was entirely true, and the publisher made her cross that out.
Yes.
But you are saying to us, so what did she mean by entirely true? So did she mean that
Well, I'm not Joan Lindsay, so I can't tell you. I'm just putting this in the book.
Right.
And this is for readers to work out, because I can't say why Joan Lindsay did that. I asked Sandra Forbes, who was the original editor on the book, why she did that. I tracked her down, and she's lovely. She's still alive. And I said, why did you cross out that? And she said, she was a little bit ambiguous, to be honest, but she said, we just made a decision to try and make it a work of fiction. So,
which is how it comes across.
Of course.
We've only got a few minutes, but we need to deal with the final chapter. So in 1987, 3 years after Joan Lindsay died, a final chapter of the book was published. And everyone had always known there was this chapter that had been excluded from the published version. Yeah. A chapter which revealed that, in the story, the girls had disappeared not because of a crime. They disappeared into a parallel time dimension through a kind of cleft in the rock, which seems to me to be a very 1960s solution to the mystery. So is that what Joan meant when she said the story was entirely true, that actually there had been slippage of the girls into time, and she believed that's where those other girls had gone. They'd been swallowed by time.
Her great-grandfather was a police magistrate at Kyneton in the late 1800s. So that's in the biography as well, about her family. And she, I don't think that's what she meant. I think she was going into a sort of a spiritual realm with that chapter. But there is certainly evidence that she told Patricia Lovell more about the book.
And who was the producer of the film?
Patricia Lovell was the producer of the film, because Patricia Lovell had, there was interviews, I believe they're with the ABC, where she says that she knows a lot more about it. And she told Peter Weir a lot more about it as well. But for good reasons, they have all just tried to leave it a mystery. And we have done that too, because if we roll over too many rocks and too many stones, we're going to lose a bit of the beauty of the original novel. So I know it's frustrating, and I'm with you all the way, but we had to kind of draw a line somewhere. So I hope you can forgive us, but this really was a biography about Joan Lindsay first and foremost.
Well, it's a fabulous
Thank
biography
you.
With this kind of infuriating
I know.
Thing that you don't tell us. I can't disguise that. So the film does sort of go down the spiritual way, doesn't the mystical way? I mean, in a way, those girls are kind of elevated into something sort of sensual and otherworldly by disappearing, which personally I find a rather creepy kind of moral. Do you see what I mean? I mean, if the girls disappear and they've got grieving families, the idea that something transcendent and wonderful happened on the rock, I think it's a bit odd.
Well, it is. I think that's a little bit of the poetic license of the film. But I'm with you all the way. I think it's a terribly tragic and traumatic story, and what the families must have felt, you know, both the fictional families and the real families. So I think Peter Weir was influenced by David Hamilton, he was also influenced by Henri Cartier-Bresson, who was a photographer. So this film was imbued with very sort of ethereal beauty, had a very painterly quality.
You know, David Hamilton is now disgraced.
I know, he's terrible. But his photographs, back in the time that Peter Weir made this film, were seen as these sort of, I shouldn't have mentioned David Hamilton, but let's go to Henri Cartier-Bresson.
But we can't go anywhere because we've got to stop because time mysteriously has closed over us and swallowed us up. Janelle, thank you for putting up such a good fight.
Thank you so much for interviewing me. It's been a pleasure, Michael.
Janelle McCulloch's book is called Beyond the Rock, The Life of Joan Lindsay and the Mystery of Picnic at Hanging Rock. It's published by Echo Publishing. And yeah, look, it's a very beautifully produced book with lots of photos. It really does evoke the world of the story and the very privileged class in which Joan Lindsay was accustomed to living.